This is Chick Flick Fix. I'm Julia Scott.
And I'm AJ Knox.
We watch chick flicks and rom-coms and decide if they need fixing. Can we make them better or can we make them weird? This week we're talking about My Best Friend's Wedding from 1997. It's directed by P.J. Hogan and written by Ronald Bass, and it stars Julia Roberts, Dermot Mulroney, Cameron Diaz, and Rupert Everett. P.J. Hogan also wrote and directed Muriel's Wedding, which I really look forward to talking about on this show. More recently, he wrote the script for The Dressmaker with Jocelyn Morehouse with Kate Winslet.
Yeah.
Ronald Bass also wrote the screenplay for How Stella Got Her Groove Back and Waiting to Exhale. So he was like the house free writer. And he also wrote The Joy Luck Club and Rain Man, the screenplays for both of those.
Okay.
So like we have some pedigree here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sarah Jessica Parker was the first person offered the role of Julianne, but she had signed on to start being Carrie on Sex and the City, so she couldn't do it.
Oh, man. That, like, there's a lot of things that date this movie. Particularly, she talks about, like, keeping her calendar, and I don't even know, she calls it, like, PowerShare or something. I'm like, I don't
Power
know.
Books.
Power Books. I'm like, I don't even know what that is anymore.
And, like, pulling out the antenna on her cell phone.
On her leather-wrapped cell phone.
Yeah, no, the parts of it are, but it's not as, it's funny because it feels less, like, dated just visually than The Lake House, for instance. Which where you're like, oh, this is so 2004.
Right.
Like the hair and some of the outfits. Whereas here, I would buy that this was, you know, both 5 and 15 years old and not like almost 25.
Yeah, with the exception of the Dear Sports Magazine email.
Yeah, where he's like, two, and just like title and not an email from. And also, why would you ever need to input from in an email? Yeah, no, that's just weird. Anyway, the original ending, after watching Michael and Kimberly leave the reception, Julianne meets someone there. That ending didn't test well, and audiences wanted to see more of George. Rightfully so, so a new ending was filmed. That man was played by John Corbett.
Okay.
So there's a lot of, like, interconnected things here. But, I mean, it's one of the things that I like about this movie, that it, like, you know, subverts tropes sort of over and over again. Like, first, it's that, spoiler, you know, the heroine doesn't win the man who we're supposed to think she deserves.
Yeah, that got me. That surprised me.
And then it doesn't have her, you know, best friend who comes in to save her has to pretend to be her boyfriend, and then they fall in love while pretending to be in love.
I did kind of think that that's what the ending was going to suggest, and I got really nervous that the
angry
movie was going to end with her turning a gay man straight.
Yeah, no. But then, and then also she doesn't, like, meet someone at the wedding.
Right.
So, like, keeps, like, nope, nope, nope. It was really funny watching this with Pontus, who hadn't seen it before, sitting there so frustrated. He's like, this isn't romantic. This is romantic. And I think he was also just, like, waiting for her to get her happy ending. Because she doesn't, like, she doesn't have any hint of a romantic happy ending, which I think is really, really cool.
Well, we'll talk about it when we get to the end, but that's the thing. I said, and this is a little bit of a spoiler for how I feel about the main character, but I'm like, as she's dancing with Rupert Everett at the end, I'm like, she doesn't deserve a happy ending. And then Jenna says, well, that's not a happy ending. I'm like, yeah, she's happy. She's laughing. And so we, like, even disagreed on, like, whether it has a happy ending for the heroine or not. I mean,
she's not in jail.
Right. I think it does have a happy ending. We'll get to my feelings on it.
We'll get to it. There is a stage musical adaptation of this, featuring songs by Burt Bacharach and Hal David, book by actually Ronald Bass and Jonathan Harvey, which was supposed to open in September 2020, will open in September 2021 on a UK and Ireland tour.
Okay. I'm like...
I want them to somehow get Dionne Warwick to go on the tour.
Well, so here's the thing. That is actually... I got immediately angry just because I am kind of just so sick of, like, movies to musicals, movies to musicals, movies to musicals. But this movie feels like it wants to be a musical.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, an opening music video. There's a karaoke, like a full song of karaoke. There's a group singing in a restaurant. And then there's like three instances where people sing to each other, just like, you know.
And dance. And
obliquely, yeah, like in conversation. And I'm like, this movie just wants to be a musical. Just let it be the musical it wants to be.
And it's like, it wants to be Mamma Mia too, because it's so much like within one. That intro music video, something that cracks me up, and I remember noticing this at the time, and then every time I've watched it, I noticed that at the very, very end, the bride miss lip-syncs part of that. She starts to say, like, hoping, but she's supposed to say loving or the other way around. And I'm like, you must have a bajillion takes of this.
Oh.
Why would you choose the one where, like, she is in focus, she's in the middle of the frame in close-up, and you see her do it wrong? Maybe the other takes were worse. And this time I actually noticed, which I hadn't done before, that one of the backup dancers, singers, also miss lip moves at one point earlier, which I'm like, why would you... I don't know, like, is it that you're editing on a very small screen so you don't see that and then it's noticeable when it's blown up on a big screen or something?
Oh, see, but I didn't even notice. I was just so confused by the whole opening. You'll have
you're like, is this But I'm a Cheerleader again?
Yeah. That's kind of what I thought.
But you hadn't seen this before.
I had not seen this. I have seen, as I realized while we were watching it, I was like, okay, I've seen the karaoke scene. And I think I've seen, like, maybe a part of the end. But, like I remember the gazebo. I remember something about, like, them in a gazebo. And I remember, like, a garden party.
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of it. That was, like, my full... I had such little knowledge of this movie that I was like, okay, Cameron Diaz is the best friend. It's Cameron Diaz's wedding. But no.
No.
I was wrong.
You were wrong. What is this movie about then?
Michael and Julianne have been best friends for years.
The one constant thing in my life is that he'll always be there.
But they were never more than that.
Call me 4 in the morning, whatever, we gotta talk.
Until he popped the question.
I called because I met someone.
To someone else.
Well.
We're getting married.
He was in love with me every day for 9 years. Me!
I can see why.
Look, she has known him for what, like 5 seconds? I can't lose him, George. I'm a busy girl. I've got 4 days to break up a wedding and steal the bride's feather. Oh!
All right. So, Julia Roberts plays Jules, which is, I love it when rom-coms do this, when they're like, we have a top A-list celebrity in our lead role, we're not changing the name, we're gonna make it their own name. This just makes it easier. But to back up, it starts with a music video featuring a bride and three bridesmaids singing, I forget what the title is, Showing That You
and
Care.
Hoping. And what's funny is this version is sung by Ani DiFranco.
Oh. Ani.
Which is so goddamn random.
Yeah. So, all right. So, yeah, it opens with a full extended song and dance number with a bride and three bridesmaids against a pink background. And then it ends with this, like, overhead, like, godlight coming on. And a lingering shot on the bride's face as she looks up. And she kind of, to me, looks sad. Like, oh. And it's one of those songs that's like, you know, treat your man right. Hold him and cuddle him and smooch him and love him and do your hair just
and
so.
And trick him into wanting to marry you because men never want to marry and women always do.
Right. And I was just, so Julia, you have to enlighten me on this because this is the first of many confusions I have around this movie. And that is, what the fuck?
I don't know.
Like, why is this in here? Like, what does it mean?
I don't know, but it feels very like a sort of certain genre of what I would think of as like a 60s movie.
Right.
Where you have sort of Bye Bye Birdie feel
that
it's
totally
of it.
Gave me Bye Bye Birdie vibes.
But I think, I don't know.
Okay.
It might be that PJ Hogan just like, likes doing these little sort of vignette-y things. We've talked earlier about how the 90s were still a time of fairly long opening credits. And I think it might also be so that you can have the credits and like set this sort of happy girly tone that doesn't necessarily run through the rest of the movie so that they didn't have to think of something else to put over it. Because you could have done the credits over that whole kitchen scene.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
But that would have set the tone for a different kind of movie, for a much more, like, hectic movie. And then you'd be confused going into most of the rest of it. So I think you get these, like, 2-3 minutes of, like, you know, settle into your comfy chair, get ready to be chick flicked.
It really does say, like, this is a chick flick. Get ready. Here we go.
It, like, gives all the dragged along husbands and boyfriends a chance to run away, I guess, or something. But yeah, it's very random.
It has no relation to any of the...
anything.
Yeah, just, like, literally anything in the movie. Like, any of the diegetic elements in the whole movie have zero connective tissue to this.
Well, I kind of wonder if it's like, well, we got a good package deal on, you know, the Burt Bacharach, Hal David box set of songs, and we can't think of any way to get this one into the movie in a natural way, so yeah. Let's do a music video. Because this could be the start for, you know, at least 50 other chick flicks.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the performers, one of the backup singers, looked, like, very familiar. Yeah. Bree Turner. What do I recognize her from? Just My Luck? Grimm? There's a couple times that happens. Paul Giamatti's in this later. It's weird.
Yeah, very much a sort of would be a cameo if he had been more famous at that time.
Exactly.
But I love retroactive cameos like that.
Yep, where you're like, oh, hey, Paul Giamatti. Good to see you here.
And I mean, this is maybe kind of a make it weird, but the way that he comes into the movie at that point and, like, the way he plays it, I would not have been surprised. I mean, surprised I would have been now because I've seen it before. But if he was like, oh, he's secretly Santa and he's here to fix it.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he's 100%. Just something about the way that he's
magical.
Like, right?
Yeah. Because
he comes in there and he's very comforting, but in a way that feels like, not that, like, he's tired of his job that day and wants to sit down and have a cigarette, but more like, all right, what is he going to do now? Does he know something about Kimmy? That, like, you know, it's really funny.
And you know that afterward, if in that movie he drops something, she takes it down to the lobby. It's like, hi, Robert dropped this off, or Roger, whatever his name is, dropped it off. And they're like,
we haven't had a bellboy in here.
Yeah, we haven't had a bellboy in 50 years. Okay.
I would watch that movie.
All right. So we have this weird dance sequence, and then we cut to the inside of a kitchen at a very fancy, very hectic restaurant. The expediter in classic late 90s angry chef mode, like a la Gordon Ramsay, is like, if this isn't perfect, I'll kill your whole family. And the guy's like, yes, chef, yes, chef. They put out this dish, which looks amazing. I'm just going to say it. Looks real good. And
it looks really good. It has looked really good every time I've seen this movie. And Potter and I kind of turned to each other and we're both like, it's been a while since we had meat. Sometimes I actually do miss it. And it's usually stuff like this. Like,
yeah.
It's been, I don't know, like 5 years at this point.
So yeah, so they bring it out. Julia Roberts is there. She's a food critic. All the chefs pile up to the kitchen door window thing. They watch her as she eats it. And all the staff is like, the maitre d's and the waiters are all staring at her. And it's like, that is bad food critic vibes, you know, like that. You don't want to stare at them while they eat.
Yeah. And like, because, you know, some food critics are anonymous, but even when they aren't, when they're famous, I, as the maitre d', wouldn't want to be standing there hovering over them. And also, like, she wouldn't give them, like, her grade right away, but also she wouldn't give it after one bite because you want to, like, you know, experience the complexities of the dish and,
yeah,
you know, go through it. But she says, I'm writing it up as innovative and, was it brave?
Inventive and confident.
That's the one.
And I'm like, that is a bad review. Like, that is, that is like...
Yeah, like, you are doing weird things and unfortunately you insist on doing them.
Yeah, yeah. That is almost like misplaced confidence.
That was a choice you made.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I could put peanut butter on spaghetti. That is inventive. And I could present it confidently. It does make it good. So she's there with her GBF, her gay best friend, Rupert Everett, George, and she is talking about how she broke up with her college boyfriend, and they've been best friends ever since. because he's called her to say that he's going to be in Chicago and he wants to meet up. Then she tells him about a pact they made in Tucson to marry each other when they were 28. And she's,
yeah, like, if we're not married by 28. And
I'm like, that's early.
It's a theme. And I wonder if, because I was like, why not 30? It's not that big of a difference. And I wonder if it is because they need Kimmy to be a junior in college still. And if she was 20 and he was 30, it would feel a bit much.
Yeah.
Like, that's the only reason I can think of to make it specifically 28. Unless it was like, you know, they were in college and were 18 and, like, it was 10 years off. But that doesn't match up with other things they say about when it was, you know? It's a really weird. But, yeah, it's like, guys, you have time.
Yeah.
This is like, not, like, this is that's not when you, you know, go on the shelf.
Yeah. So, of course, we get set up to the premise, right?
It's also very funny that I'm sitting here like, 28, you're babies. I got married when I was 28. In all of our context was very young. We were like the first people in our group of friends to get married. But that's a Swedish context and also Swedish, like, urban context. But it was very funny how you look at these people and be like, you can't make decisions, not just for the 20-year-old, but for the supposed adults. Also, she has, like, you know, she's this very successful food critic, food writer, and she's on a book tour. And I'm like, I hate you.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, not the another check of the, whatchamacallit, the chick flick character creation guide. Yeah, she's basically a journalist. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Kimmy's going to be an architect.
Yep. And yeah, we got the trifecta. She goes back to her apartment. She calls him back and he tells her, like, hey, I met this. And she's like, oh, remember that time when we were in Tucson? And he goes, I think about that night all the time. But that's not why I'm calling. I'm calling because I met somebody and we're getting married on Sunday. And a million people are flying in.
And it's because, like, these are very, very rich, waspy people.
Yes.
With a lot of connections and friends. And because I read so much, like, historical romance and historical fiction, I'm like, what are they not telling us about Kimmy? Because that is not the kind of wedding that you really can whip up in a week, and two, right, really want to whip up in a week. You want to, like, have all the stuff. You know, I'm like, does she turn into, like, a cockatoo at midnight once a month? Like, why are they trying to get her married off? Is there an inheritance? I mean, that is kind of where I guess we could find a ton of make it weird.
Oh, yeah. What is her secret?
Because if it was just like, well, we just really want to get married quickly because we love each other so much, but you can't have both that and this giant society wedding, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bit odd. So she, you know, falls off the bed while she's talking to him, and he says that, and he's like, I'm getting married on Sunday. She goes, but it's Wednesday. And he goes, well, actually, everything starts tomorrow.
Because it's one of those four-day weddings.
Yeah, and I'm coming to Chicago for this wedding. And so she goes to O'Hare to meet him and his beautiful new bride, and she's walking through O'Hare, and my instant gut, I just recognized the inside of that airport. My, like, instant reaction was like, ugh, I hate O'Hare. I hate O'Hare. I hate it. It's, like, the worst airport.
I've had to run through it.
Yes, I have. Everybody has had to run through O'Hare because it's all spread out. It's so crowded. It's, like, way smaller. It's, like, the hallways are narrower than it needs to be, and it's much longer than it needs, like.
But I think she's in New York and she flies to Chicago.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, she flies to Chicago because then Everett has to fly in from New York. Oh, so she flies to Chicago,
that's right,
and he meets her
there.
Then they
say later that she's from New York. I just assumed she was in Chicago on her trip or whatever. So she's in Chicago. She meets him and his fiance Cameron Diaz, and she's like, I've always wanted a sister. And then I was like, wait a minute, did he tell her that she was his sister? Like, what is happening? But no, it turns out that, like, kind of everybody knows that he used to be in love with her, and he still, like, kind of holds a candle for her.
But mostly they're like best friends.
Best friends, yeah.
It's funny because it's both at the same time, like, well, he, you know, he had feelings for her for such a long time, and they're now completely platonic, basically best friends.
Yeah. And to be fair, I have two of my best girlfriends are people I dated once, you know. But also, to be fair, both of those people I dated for a very short amount of time.
Well, that's the thing. These two dated for a month.
Yeah.
Or as she puts it, one hot month.
Yeah. Mine were not necessarily hot months. They were just like, we're better friends, aren't we? Yep, yep. So also Cameron Diaz's maid of honor is unable to make it. So she asks Julia Roberts.
Because she shattered her pelvis on spring break.
She says like the most waspy, wealthy sentence. Like she shattered her pelvis while dancing on a yacht in Aruba or whatever it is during spring break. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, that. There's so many opportunities for, like, I only understood half of those words. But yeah, so she asks Julia Roberts to be her maid of honor, of course. And she's like, why don't you ask your, like, promote another bridesmaid, which is the appropriate question. And she says, my bridesmaids are my sisters, they're sluts. They're Debbie
sluts. No, they're
sluts.
Her, I think they're like her cousins or aunts, yeah, or something. Her, yeah, like, they're vengeful sluts. And part of me here is, again, there's so much more here that I'm so curious about and that I think would be an interesting thing and would also add a level of complexity to the relationship between Jules and Kimmy, because Kimmy seems 150% like someone who would be in a sorority.
Oh,
and would, yeah, have a gaggle of friends in like matching pastel sweater sets.
Yeah, you know? Why does she have no friends?
Why does she have no friends? Is it like, because if it's, you know, she went to private school and somewhere in Switzerland, so none of her school friends or whatever. But if it was like I have a hard time making female friends, then that's also super interesting.
Yeah.
Because like they would need to have, because that size wedding also, like, it seems weird to only have two bridesmaids, you know, like she would, yeah, have a bunch of cousins and third cousins and like her sorority sisters and everything. So it's, again, like it's a missed opportunity to either make a joke of it, of like,
right,
there are a lot of broken pelvises, nobody could make it, or to explore that, like, because Jules doesn't seem to be able to make female friends either, just, yep, from the little that we learn from her.
Well, we know that she's not girly, and she doesn't like girly things.
Mm-hmm. And she doesn't like love.
Right. She's like, okay, I guess I'm going to be your bridesmaid. They go to like a little like welcome event gathering, rehearsal dinner-y type of thing. They're going up the elevator, and Jules has made it her mission, as she has told George, to break up this wedding. She's going to convince
steal the bride's fella.
Yeah, she's going to convince Dermot Mulroney, which always makes me think, I think I mentioned this, I think we've had another movie with him in it, but if we haven't, always makes me think of the SNL skit, Dermot Mulroney or Dylan McDermott.
Oh no.
And they bring one of them out, and they're like, all right, is this Dermot Mulroney or Dylan McDermott? And the contestants are like, I don't know. I have no idea. Because they also look kind of similar. But this is Dermot Mulroney. So they are talking about him, and she's like, oh, don't you hate it how he snores? Don't you hate it how it this? Blah, 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 blah. And Cameron Diaz is in the elevator, and she's like, you know, I made a list of all his faults. You know what I did with that? And then she stops the elevator, and Julia Roberts is claustrophobic, which we don't know, and never comes back again. It's like a big deal in this scene, and then it never returns. And she's like, oh my God, let me out of this elevator.
Which, goes, weirdly enough, now that you mentioned that, I almost kind of like it, so that it's not like a plot point. It's just like, it's realistic that people just don't like to be, yeah, shut in an elevator.
Being in an emergency stopped elevator. And she's just like, I took that list and I threw it away. I love him. He's perfect. Blah, 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 blah. And so they get to the floor. Julia Roberts runs out of the elevator because she's both claustrophobic and, you know, upset. And
clumsy. Charming.
Yeah, immediately bumps into a maitre d' or a server holding a tray of hors d'oeuvres, and then the sisters pop up and they're like, is this the, here's the bride and the woman she'll never live up to. And I'm like, oh boy. Like, so like everybody knows, and I really like them. They're, mm-hmm, fun. They're bizarre. They're like out of a different movie a little bit. So we meet the family, and everyone's just talking about how much Dermot Mulroney loves her and how great she is and how excited they are. Like she's kind of the star of the day. And I'm like, if I were the bride, I'd be very upset right now.
But I could see also just like being this incredibly waspy, very rich family to be like, oh, it's a, you know, this sort of artsy bohemian New York writer and she's wearing pants, you know, like it's
yeah.
even Kimmy's just like, ooh, exotic, this tiny like exotic flavor to my wedding, you know?
Yeah. So then Jules goes to visit Dermot Mulroney and the male members of the family at the White Sox game. And my favorite thing happens. She comes in carrying a tray of empty cups.
They are so empty because like
so empty, and there's like overhead shots of them.
And there's like 12 of them as well. Like these 12 mugs. And
that's
she
a very, I used to be a server. That is a freaking heavy tray. Like you don't just like casually walk around and chat. You're like, somebody take this fucking beer.
You're waving it.
Yeah. Oh man. I was just like, come on movie, do a better job with these cups. They're so empty. So she delivers the beers. We meet the Dermot Mulroney's family, male members of his family, including his little brother, who she like flirts with hardcore. And it's like weird, who is the older brother of Malcolm in the Middle. We also meet the rest of her male members of the family. And the big thing we get to know here is that her family is wealthy, 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 while Dermot Mulroney's family is not. And we get that at the rehearsal dinner where they go to Barra the Kudas or some like weird like themed seafood restaurant where people are wearing lobster costumes. But that's jumping ahead. So we get to know them a little bit. One of the things that she has mentioned to Cameron Diaz is how goofy it is that Dermot Mulroney loves karaoke. So, of course, Julie Roberts, to break them up, drags them to a karaoke bar. And they sabotage Cameron Diaz and make her sing. Also in this scene is the first time that I feel like I learned that she was an undergrad and that she was 20. And I'm like, oh, no. But yet she orders a beer.
Yeah, I was thinking of that too, because he says first, like, she's a junior at something something.
But they're talking about her, like, leaving her last year of school, and I'm like, wait, what? And so she's a baby, so she gets karaoke bombed, she gets up, she has to sing karaoke, and of course she can't sing. And I definitely think, like, this is Cameron Diaz's actual singing voice. Like, I don't know why, I picture her being, like, a bad singer, because I feel like she's done it in other movies. Also, I'm just going to say it, like, Cameron Diaz is bad in this movie. Like, I know this was not her first movie, but it like, feels like it. And it was, to be fair, it was, like, early in her career. This was probably, like, one of her earlier ones. I think this is right before Something About Mary, because I feel like that was 98. But
yeah, I think one of her first things was, yeah, her very first role was in The Mask, and that was in 94.
Yeah, and she's just like, so you know how in 9 months, we talked about 9 months, and we talked about how Hugh Grant like pulls a lot of faces and does like a lot of big acting, mm-hmm. and she does that here, and I'm like, I don't like it.
Yeah, she's basically just like a golden retriever, for better or for worse.
Yeah, and she is kind of a plot point in this movie. Anyway, so she gets up, she does bad karaoke, the bar starts booing her, but then of course, like, everyone starts to get into it. She kind of gets a little more confident, even though she's bad, and it's just like leans into it, which I kind of appreciated, because I've definitely been in a karaoke bar where like somebody's awful and the bar just like gets behind them, and it's like actually mm-hmm. kind of fun and endearing. So of course we get the karaoke scene where she wins the bar over, and then Julie Roberts starts to like plant these seeds of like, he needs to, like, one of them needs to leave their career for the other one. Right? Like, that's kind of what is going to happen.
Well, they've already decided that she's going to not go back to school for her senior year. And I'm like, you've already done most of it. Also, he's on the road all the time. You're just going to be, like, in hotel rooms. You have tons of money. You can, you know, stay in school and then travel to meet him every week still.
Yeah, go
because
every
you're
weekend.
Not going to get anything out of just, like, traveling around the country with him. And also, they talk a lot about how crappily paid his job is. He's going to support two people?
Yeah. It's, I assume he just, he assumes that her family will just continue to support them. But yeah, so Jules, like, plants seeds of doubt in both of them and is like, you know, and they end up getting in this huge fight at dinner about, like, whose job is worth more, who's going to give up their job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's really, like, awful. And it was at this point in the movie that I realized Julia Roberts might be the villain of this story. Like, this is awful.
It's, again, like, with the subverting of the tropes, because at first you're like, well, she's the main character. We meet her first. We're on her side, whatever.
Right.
And then, like, all right, wacky hijinks. And then, you know, there's all the things that you're supposed to do for your love in a romantic comedy, but they're so dastardly that you can't cheer for her anymore. But they're not actually that much dastardlier than your average rom-com, which is a really funny, like, hey, you guys. And they even, like, at the very end, when Cameron Diaz just, like, sort of lists the things that she's done, yes, to very clearly be like, hey, you guys.
You're a sociopath. What was the movie where there's the slideshow and she's
at the 27 end? Dresses.
Oh, yeah. It reminded me of that, but, like, for the whole movie. So, yeah. So they get in this big fight, but then they reconcile, like, immediately. And she's like, dang, drat, my plan didn't work. So she gets drunk and eats.
I really want to know how long they've been together, because we don't really find out. It sounds like, you know, a couple weeks, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we do get a sense later when she's talking to George that the proposal was, like, an impulse.
Mm-hmm.
So, or not George, to Michael. But yeah, so she goes back to her hotel. She gets drunk on minibar booze and chocolate, and she drunk dials George, and it's like, he's in the middle of a dinner party, and she leaves this loud message on his phone of, like, I need you to help me break up this wedding. Like, it's not working. Get over here. So he flies out to Chicago to come save her.
And it's really, really funny, because he like, asks the dinner party after she hangs up. He's like, coffee, anyone? And I'm like, oh, no, no, no. That dinner party would right away be like, ooh, that's messy. Tell me more.
Yeah, that would be like, okay. That would become a much more interesting dinner party. But yeah, so he comes out to save her. They go to visit Dermot Mulroney, and she digs herself a little deeper and says that George is her fiancé.
And they use their one F-bomb right there.
Yeah, yeah.
He's coming down to fuck me. And it's just like, whoa! That
fuck me. Yeah. And it was, like, it was funny. Like, a good, that to me is a good example of, like, a well-placed, very surprising. And so the problem is, too, right now, I'm watching everything with subtitles on, and because we use a sound machine for our daughter when she's getting sleepy, and so half the time it's like we're out here trying to get her to go to sleep with a little portable sound machine, so we can't hear the TV. So we had the subtitles on, so I saw the line before I heard it, and so some of the, like, the guttural impact of that was lost on me, but it was still a good, a good use of the one F-bomb. George is immediately like, oh no, I'm going to make this. You just drug me into this. I'm going to make your life hell. And, like, I kind of appreciate that. I kind of appreciate
it. It's like, you made your bed, now I'm going to eat cookies in it.
Yeah, exactly. And so he starts to, like, be very, like, all over her, like, lovey-dovey, kind of gropey, and like, ooh, like, I'm a straight guy who just can't keep his hands off my woman. And they even they even address, like, Dermot Mulroney. He's like, you know, it's weird, because the way Jules always talked about you, I kind of thought you were, and he's like, gay? He's, yeah. And she goes, he just acts gay sometimes. And they laugh about it, and I'm like, ooh, that's a little cringy 90s. And then, thankfully, Dermot Mulroney goes, why would you do that? Like, kind of like, is the voice of reason in that moment. It's like, basically,
and
the
Rupert
audience
Everett
version
goes, to get the ladies.
Yeah.
And Julia Roberts goes, it worked on me. Really good writing, because it's so bizarre.
It is so weird. But I am glad that Dermot Mulroney, like, straight up, like, is the audience voice of reason. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So they go to, like, a rehearsal dinner at this, like, crab shack, and of course, again, now it is all about Jules and not about the bride-to-be, and they're like, tell us how you met. Everyone's so excited that she's engaged, and they're like, tell us how you met. And he's like, I will tell you the story of how we met. We met in an insane asylum. I was there meeting Dionne Warwick, or at least he thought he was Dionne Warwick. And they get into this whole story about how she was there visiting a chef who she had driven insane with a bad review. She was in there wearing pink. And Michael's like, well, you never wear pink. He goes, she does sometimes. You know, so he's basically like undermining everything she's built up about herself. And then he's like, I saw her and I turned to Dionne and I said, you know, what do you think about her, Dionne? And then they sing forever you'll be in my heart.
Yeah, say a little prayer. Love you.
Say a little prayer. Yeah, I couldn't think of the title.
Which and, just amazingly escalates into a giant sing-along, including waving
lobster-handed servers, and the entire restaurant sings along, and everyone knows all the lyrics. Everyone knows like when to chime in as backup singers and when to let George kind of take
when
the
to
lead.
Do harmonies.
This is another. I'm like, again, this movie just wanted to be a musical. George leaves. She decides, like, I still need to break up this wedding. She tells Dermot Mulroney that, like, oh, George is in love with me, but he doesn't, like, get it that the wedding's off. He goes, oh, good, because I got really jealous. And she's like, oh, okay. And then he's like, why don't we just hang out? So they hang out, and then they talk about the affairs they're going to have together, which I'm like, this guy clearly doesn't want to get married to her.
Well, I think it might be a case of one of those weird, like, non-relationship friendships where either one or both of you kind of harbors feelings for the other and or is, like, stoking the other person's feelings to always have someone who, like, has feelings for them. And then you make the not-jokey jokes.
And then Dermot Mulroney sings to her. He sings their song and they dance on the boat. And I'm like, another, okay, movie, just be the musical you want to be. Like, live your best life. So, eventually she goes to get Kimmy's dad. This is the night before the wedding. She goes to get Kimmy's dad, about to take him to some event. And she asks to use his computer in his big fancy office. And he's like, sure, I've got a few more things to wrap up, go for it. So she goes into his office, she opens his chunky laptop, and she starts drafting an email.
With, again, completely accurate and functional, like, technology.
I'm pretty sure in 97,
routes.
Email was a little bit better understood than this.
Or not.
Maybe not, because You've Got Mail was 99.
Also, she's brought a printout of
She's drafted this letter. Yeah, including, like, a lot of, like, revisions. But, yeah, she's drafted this letter that she's going to send to Dermot Mulroney's boss to basically say, like, hey, I've tried to offer him a position. Hey, I'm the head of this company. I've tried to offer him a position, but he won't come work for me in as long as he works for you. So please fire him. Basically, weird. So she drafts this email on his computer, and then she is like, "Wait, no, don't send this. Don't be stupid. Like, why would you send this? Doesn't make any sense. You're not a monster." And then she's like, save for later. Yeah, do that. Like, cause
so that I can come here and show it to him.
So that I don't have to actually send
it. Which is also, like, because she's already been planting this stuff, she could be like, I heard Kimmy and her dad talking.
Yeah, you don't need to, like, give evidence. It's, like, weird. So she saves the email, and then we see the boss talking to his secretary, and he's like, all right, I'm heading out. I drafted a bunch of emails after lunch. Can you send them for me? Which I'm like, again, what? And she's like, sure thing. So we're like, uh-oh. They go back to Rupert Everett's hotel. He picks up his mail.
And he has a fax.
He has a fax. Yes, he has a little fax waiting for him from his boss. It's like, hey, I think you should hear about what you're marrying into. Here's the email I got today. So she's like, oh, goodness. You deal with this. I'm going to go outside and have a cigarette. So he calls Cameron Diaz to call off the wedding. She goes outside, has a cigarette in the hallway. Paul Giamatti magically arrives as Santa Claus. And Santa Claus is a bellhop, gives her some sage advice, shares a cigarette with her, and is like this voice of calm and reason. Dermot Mulroney opens the door. She falls in.
And then Dermot Mulroney sucks the wedding ring off her finger.
Yes.
That she has put on and can't get off. Which I'm like...
Yeah. Then the next morning she wakes up and the wedding is back on. They're having their garden party brunch. She goes to the garden party, more singing. Baby Bro is there with his friends, singing with Helium, which is like a cute little bit.
And she's like running interference back and forth because he hasn't said anything. She hasn't said anything because Kimmy's hoping that he's going to change his mind. And he, you know, very clearly is like, you know, something about this isn't right. And I think it's really sweet, actually, when she's running back and forth, both of them, their first thought are of the other person.
Yes.
You know, they ask, is he okay? Is she okay? Which, because earlier in the film when they talk about, I remember reading about this for quite a while ago, that if you ask someone about their partner, even if you ask your partner, you know, what do they like about you, their answers shouldn't only be about them. Right. Not like, you're good to me, you do this for me. Right. And he's like, she lets me hold her. She has no, like, actual, you know, qualities aside from letting him be affectionate. It is very sweet, you know, towards the end when they're not like, I'm angry at him, I'm sad, she, you know, messed up. Both of them ask how the other person is doing, showing very clearly that their first thought and their first care is for each other.
Yeah, they actually care about each other. So, so she is kind of like bouncing between the two of them, and she pulls him aside to basically, like, she's like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to tell him that I love him. Like, it just has to happen.
Because the wedding wasn't quite on. They're just there in this weird, and she somehow manages to get the wedding back on and then decides to tell him.
Yes.
He's like, thank goodness you were here.
Yeah, she reconciles them.
Still trying to not seem like the bad person.
Yeah, she reconciles everything. And then she's like, I'm going to tell you I love you. And then I'm going to kiss you. And then, Kimmy saw it. Kimmy runs away. He runs after her. She runs after him. That's the visual I, like, remember from this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is, like, them running across the lawn at, like, a garden party. And as they're running along, her mom's like, she's from New York, which I'm like, what do you think New Yorkers do? They just chase people.
And this is where there is a very, very good sort of sequence of events because they all, you know, everybody is chasing after each other in cars as well. She steals like a bagel truck.
Yeah.
And then she has this amazing conversation with George.
Yep.
Where George just like lays it out. So he's chasing Kimmy. You're chasing him. No one is chasing you. That's your answer.
Yeah. Get it?
And for some reason, that's the first time anything actually gets through to her. But the way he frames that is just very good. Like, you are chasing around. You stole a bread truck.
Yeah. With a cassette in it that's playing What the World Needs Now is Love. By Burt Bacharach. Wait a minute. And
Burt Bacharach and Hal David have written almost every song in this movie.
Oh, so that's why. It's basically
a Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That makes some sense. I get it now.
Which is sad because that was going to be basically my make a weird is do it a musical. And then I looked up and there's
that was going to be mine too. But I have another one in the can.
Because what I wanted was like a Hamilton style musical where there is basically no spoken dialogue.
Oh, yeah. That'd be good. That'd be good for this. Actually, a lot of things would make this better in my mind. Anyway. So she chases him down. They get to she finds Dermot Mulroney sitting in the bus depot, train depot, something like that. And he tells her about the engagement. She realizes that he really loves Cameron Diaz. So she calls the sister and she's like, let's get the wedding going. She goes, oh, yeah, that might be tricky because the bride slipped out while my sister was licking ice statue David's penis. And now they're trying to, which I'm like, this is such a weird little, again, the stepsisters or whatever they are. I call them the wicked stepsisters. That's what they are in my mind.
And this is where Pontius was like, that's not what you get stuck when you lick metal. What is this? And I'm like, this is not the main thing to object to.
Kind of has to be pretty cold out, I would imagine, already. Yeah. Not summer in Chicago. But yeah.
But the cousins tell her, or the other cousin tells her that she's at the baseball park, like likes to go to the fancy box to think.
Yeah. So she chases her to the stadium. She meets Kimmy in a bathroom and they hash it out in front of a crowd of very invested strangers who are like cheering them on. And again, so many crowd scenes.
I think I already got into this a little bit, but like I that scene is actually, because first you're like, why is there an audience and why are they, but like in a woman's bathroom, like it makes sense that it's really hard to not, like they don't have to do that yelling cat fight.
Yeah.
Because everyone would just pause anyway because they get so loud. But I like that they kind of get to be a stand-in for the audience. Like when Kimmy points out all these dastardly deeds.
Yeah.
They can go, because there's no way to react to you kissed my fiance on my wedding day other than, ooh. But then they also get to be there because you can feel it's like, ooh, this is going to get, like, there's a weird little mob mentality going on there. And then they have this, like, sort of sisterly reunion forgiveness thing. And I'm still like, I don't know that I would let her be at the wedding, even though she technically, you know, reunified them because they only needed to be reunified because...
Because
she manipulated, lied, broken, entered, all this stuff.
Yeah, so they reconcile, the wedding is back on, they go to the wedding, and I'm like, okay, so this is going to actually end with, and I was still waiting for him to, like, you know, do you take Cameron Diaz, and for him to go, I don't.
You were waiting for the sort of Mrs. Robinson
like style. Something to happen to match them up. But no, they get married. They are at the reception and she like gifts them, their song as a song because they don't have a song yet. And then they like take off like just married. Bye.
And I really wish that Dermot Mulroney didn't come back to hug her goodbye, because it's a really good scene when she sees them leave. She tries to, you know, say goodbye and then leave, because that sort of, you know, symbolizes that they have moved on. She can't demand to be a part of their lives and his life in that way anymore. But no, he finds her and hugs her.
Yeah, it's weird. And so then George calls her on her cell phone and he's like, hey, how's the wedding going? Did you? And she goes, well, I did what I came here to do. And he goes, break them up? She goes, nope,
I goodbye.
Got them back together. And now I'm sitting here at this wedding and I don't know. And he starts like describing what she's wearing, her lavender dress, her hair, that she's like drumming her nails, that she hasn't eaten her cake. And she's like, wait a minute, I haven't told you my dress was lavender. And so she's like walks around the wedding and it's a fun little bit that he's like.
He like narrates it in a very flowery romance kind of way.
Yeah. And then the crowd parts and she sees him and they dance and she laughs. And this was where I was like, uh-oh, is he going to have been in love with her this whole time? And is this movie going to do like a she can turn gay people straight thing? But nope. It's just like this movie is ultimately about like not like the importance of non-romantic love, you know, and that's it. And they dance and I don't know.
Yeah, it is because there's so much here where you're like, nobody in this movie is reasonable.
Right.
And I wish that it was a less bananas story, because I really like the subversion of the, like this is, you know, one of the canon rom-coms where you don't get the classic happy ending.
Yeah.
And where the movie multiple times sets you up to expect it.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish, and you could see it as like, you know, playing with the trope, because she is so evil that you start out cheering for her and then you're like, wait, am I still cheering for her? You know? My husband suggested that the villain in this movie is actually the institution of marriage, because it's held up as this like amazingly, like it's so important and this is her last chance and without it she will never be, like everybody is just like hurtling toward the institution of marriage without thinking of why or what matters to them. And I was like, maybe this should be your podcast.
Yeah, I don't know. Because that is a really good point. Like, this is not a wedding-friendly movie. Or a marriage-friendly movie, I should say.
Do you have a favorite character?
I have a few. I like Magical Paul Giamatti. I do really like the Wicked Stepsisters, as I'm calling them. Harry Shearer, of The Simpsons fame, who voices Mr. Burns, Ned Flanders, and many others, is the author in the book reading.
Right? It's such
a weird little cameo, and I'm like, what? That I just, like, I was endeared by that cameo. But I think ultimately, it's going to be George. I think I like George the best. I think that, he's the voice of encouragement of like, yeah, go do this. But he's also like eventually the voice of reason. I think his lines are funny. I think the story of how they met is one of my favorite scenes in the movie. He kind of steals every scene that he's in for me. What about you?
Yeah, no, it's basically George. Like, I feel like he's not even necessarily the voice of encouragement. He's like the voice of sarcastic encouragement.
Yeah.
Where he's like, you're going to do this anyway. It's going to go horribly. I guess I'll say sure and then just watch everything burn around you.
Yeah.
You know, where because, you know, editors have to do a lot of like wrangling and handholding of their authors.
Yeah.
So like presumably she does not make enough money to like have him be only her editor.
Right.
So like he probably has to, you know, placate a lot of weird big egos.
Yeah.
But
I also like how he's like very witty and very quick. That elevates the comedy of the scenes that he's in a way that the other scenes just don't have. And I even love, like, when he's telling the story of how they met, he's like, we had a real Doris Day Rock Hudson thing going on.
Yeah, right? It's
you
so
know,
good.
Like, there's so many, like, great, like, jokes, like, that to him, he knows are just going to go right over everybody's head.
Mm-hmm. He's like, love the purse, the shoes, the hair, love you.
Yeah. There's just, like, a lot of really fun bits with that for him.
Do you have a favorite part?
I think it is that rehearsal dinner scene.
The sing-along?
Yeah. It's not even necessarily the sing-along, although sing-along is just wacky. But it's like the whole story, the whole how they met.
How awkward only Jules and Michael are and everyone else is having a blast.
Yeah. I love it. It reminds me of stuff like the serendipity when they're like describing who they need the gloves for and how they, you know, and like the whole story they're making, like the improvised how we met thing is can be a really good source of humor. So I really liked that. Yeah. What about you?
I mean, basically the same. There are little bits I like. Like, I like how they're having this, like, describing all the things that annoy you about a person competition in the elevator.
Yeah.
Like it's,
that's a good scene.
And it's also, like, there are so many little funny things how, you know, Cameron Diaz talks about how she used to be like Jules and not believe in love. And I'm like, sweetie, you're barely post-pubescent.
Yeah.
Like, nobody believes in love when they're 16. But, so it's the whole of it is, you know, they're a bunch of funny things. I don't know if we even need to talk about the end, because I feel like we've handled that.
Yeah, I'll just reiterate, I don't think she deserves it. I think it is, the movie does treat it as a happy ending for her, even though it's not romantic ending. But I don't think she deserves that. I think she deserves to be at this wedding alone. I think that she deserves to, like, awkwardly
have to answer a lot of uncomfortable questions from aunties. And
yeah.
The only thing that is kind of not necessarily redeemable, but, you know, she's young enough that she can process through this. And I think parts of it are also, like, some things are hinted at. Like, oh, they've helped each other through, you know, loss of parents, all this stuff. And I'm like, she has some trauma she needs to deal with. And it may be childhood trauma or early adulthood trauma. But, like, she's only 28. So she can hopefully, like, realize that none of this was okay.
Yeah.
And then, so basically that. But, yeah, she, her happy ending is basically that she's survived it more or less intact.
Yeah.
So on Rotten Tomatoes, this actually has a 73% fresh rating from both critics and audiences,
which
I think is interesting. And it has a 6.3 on IMDb. What would you give this out of 10 red curly hairdos?
I like how we're changing it every week.
I love when she says that you're two-faced, big-haired food critic.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
I also, when she shows up at O'Hare Airport, she's, like, walking with her, like, back to the camera, and her hair takes up a lot of the frame. And I said, ugh, I hate O'Hare. And Jenna's like, what? I was like, it's just awful. And we had this, like, mini conversation about how much I hate Chicago O'Hare. And she thought I was talking about how much I hate Julia Roberts' hair. And I'm like, no, I'm not that. I'm not that picky. Listen, I will be straight up. I know that this is a beloved chick flick. I know people love this movie. Jenna loves this movie. She was like, there's point, like the brothers or the friends all singing with the helium, the opening number. She had all these moments where she's like quoting along with it. She loves this movie. I really despised everything, almost everything about this movie, except for Rupert Everett and like the few little fun cameos and a couple little moments. But like, I'm going to give it like a 3, honestly. I know people are going to be mad at me, but I didn't like this movie. I found the main character pretty reprehensible and unlikable. Even though I really like Julia Roberts in a lot of things, I just found that character kind of awful. I didn't want them to get together. I didn't like Dermot Mulroney. I don't like Cameron Diaz. Yeah.
This was just not set up for success for you.
No, this... And I kind of... You know what? And I'm kind of bummed, too. Because I wanted this to be a little cotton candier. I like that it's subversive. I like that it ends with, like, not the wedding. I like all that. I just, yeah, it's just missing something for me.
It's so hard because it has, the funny thing is, because I've seen it a bunch of times, I don't get as annoyed at all the horrible things. They're more just like, yes, this is, you know, just objectively horrible things, but there are enough things that are just like nostalgically comforting in between those. So like, I'm not shocked enough to be put off of the other things.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense? Like, there are certain movies like that. It's not like, oh, I will forget anything. It's just like, I like so many of the little bits and I'm not any more as put off by the horrible things. So I think it's like a 6 or 7, like a... Mm.
Yeah, that's fair. Like, that's kind of what I was hoping this movie would be for me.
Well, you can't, but well, we can return to it in 15 years' time and see what you think then. This is one of those weird movies where it has so many flaws, but I can't really think of a way to fix it without making it an entirely different movie.
Yeah.
Because if you're like, well, they have to be tiny machinations or like, no, but it's like, but then it's not this movie.
Right.
You know, because it is such a like chain of events.
Well, and because when we talk about fixing it, one of the things we talk about is like getting rid of problematic elements or kind of like, you know, making it a little tidier or neater or, you know...
Or putting in a fun thing that they missed.
Right. And for me, it's like, I don't like the main character. So I don't know how to
fix it. Yeah, like fixing this movie would be like, well, the whole story is only about George and Julia Roberts is just this weird little like kink in his plans that he has to travel out to deal with.
Yeah.
That is the way to fix this movie. But again, that's an entirely different movie, but I would watch that.
Yeah.
For weird, again, like I had a Hamilton style musical or again, it's George's movie. That's basically my make it weird. What was yours?
My weird was also like just go full musical, but I also had one in the can, which is in the How They Met story, George talks about meeting her at a mental asylum where she was there because she had driven a chef to insanity with a bad review. So here's my thought. This whole movie...
Is that Chef Hannibal?
Yes. No, this whole movie is a fever dream while she's in a coma because... And the very beginning, that chef tried to kill her with poisoned food. And so, like, the call from Michael that she's talking about sets off this, like, imaginative streak that goes through her, like, her thoughts because she's been poisoned.
Or the whole movie happens in the French chef's head where he's trying to figure out how this restaurant critic can be such a horrible person. And he's locked up and he's like, well, she must be awful. So he just like imagines all these like other awful version. Things.
Yeah. Then we could get, oh, you could do this in like three, you could tell this story in like 3 different points of view and like full Rashomon style, except like the last one, she's the hero because you're in her head or something like that.
But I kind of like the idea that none of it is actually real. It's just the chef being like, well, she must be a horrible person. So I'm going to imagine a story of horrible things that she would do because she's such a
horrible person. So for my original one, it was like all the little hints of real life start bleeding in. So like Rupert Everett, like talking about like, I met her at a mental institution where she was there. And it's like, wait, that really happened, you know? And so it's like,
yeah,
all these lies that she's concocted start to like become reality because she's like half dream, half creating alive, a story. Half, yeah, yeah. Half you know, revisiting her life flashing before her eyes. I don't know how it ends.
Suddenly I'm like, can we play this movie backwards Memento style?
Oh, that would be kind of interesting.
Where she's just like, wait, why am I trying to break up this wedding? What's going on? I don't know.
Yeah.
Did we learn anything from this
movie? Oh, man. I learned that, like, I generally tend to be enamored by the really chick flicky chick flicks. And I kind of learned that I have a threshold.
Well, I think, you know, this also is kind of a special case. I learned or was reminded of the fact that I will always think all ages a bit younger than myself are tiny babies, even though I didn't feel like a tiny baby at the time. Basically. Next week, we'll be talking about The Truth About Cats and Dogs. I briefly was like, should we do July as just like July Roberts month? But we'll come back to Julia Roberts.
Oh, I'm sure
you can
will.
Find our show notes. our show notes at theincomparable.com/chickflickfix. We're chickflickfix on Twitter and Instagram. Give us a ping. Tell someone about the podcast. Leave a review. We'll be back next week. Say goodbye, AJ.
Goodbye, AJ. Total sidebar too is like the food in Hannibal, the TV show, looks so good. They hired like professional like food designers to make it look as appealing as humanly possible, so that like you would A, feel like unsure if at that moment he was actually eating people or just like lamb or whatever.
And are you supposed to find it mouthwatering?
Exactly. And like, you're supposed to be like, that looks real good. And it was like specifically meant to like toy with your emotions as a viewer, which I kind of love. That is not this movie. That is a weird make it weird though. So they go out to the restaurant.
Food critic who's a cannibal.
Oh, yeah, that's a good. That's a
who,
good.
Like
thing.
Brings in her own bacon flakes to every restaurant.
Oh no! Do you mind if I use my own bacon bits on this? So I got them from a friend.
Can I bring a friend to dinner?